but we needs a few good taters.
What's taters?
Potatoes. What? Boil them, mash them, stick them in a stew. Lovely big golden chips.
It's Britney, bitch.
And Iraq, everywhere like such a.
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie! Out!
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Remember Shuffle. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is my co-host, Giordano.
Hello!
Doing his best Gimli impression.
That's Gandalf.
Damn it. And today, we have reassembled the Fellowship from our Fellowship of the Ring episode. We are joined by John. Say hi, John.
Hi, good to be back on and talk about the best of the three.
Oh,
ooh, hot take. And we are joined by Radu. Say hi, Radu.
Hey, what's up?
Yes, we will be discussing the Two Towers. And we need a swear jar for every time we accidentally say Twin Towers on this episode. I just, I always got 9/11 on the mind. Yeah, and so, as we were planning this episode, we had the realization that we did kind of, in the words of Dr. Tobias Funke, blow our wad on a metaphorical dry run. And now we got something of a sticky mess on our hands because we did an episode on the Fellowship of the Ring, but we kept bringing in stuff from the later films. And we wanted to return to Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy because it is so consequential for how movies could have gone and how they actually went. But we will be limiting our scope today to talk specifically about what makes the Two Towers unique and good. But we will try to be a little bit diligent about limiting our scope to Two Towers. Nobody bring up Return of the King stuff. We need to run this back one more time. But John, actually, since you brought it up, why do you like Two Towers best? Because I think Giordano and I are on Team Fellowship as the best one.
I really fought between Fellowship and Two Towers the most. When it comes to the real nostalgia hit, what got its hooks in me, it's definitely, I mean, Fellowship is what got me hooked, and Two Towers is what was like, yes, I made the correct choice. This is about what to define my nerdy childhood around. This is everything I ever wanted. I believe even my now wife, in one of the first times we went out, we were talking about Lord of the Rings, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm more of a Rohan man. And you know what? It paid off. We're now married. And that was something that she saw as a positive. She was like, oh, this guy's into Lord of the Rings. And it was really the Two Towers. It's all about Rohan. So it's, you know, she's been there in my life. Helm's Deep was the coolest thing I had ever seen in theaters. And the first Warhammer I ever bought was Rohan.
Nice.
Warriors of Rohan. So it's very near and dear in many. Anyways,
hell yeah.
You like the nomadic feudal society the Rohan people live in?
Yeah, the horse lords. I always thought the aesthetic was very nice. Those rich colors, the gold green trim.
They're land Vikings, man. It's sick. They live in the wooden longhouses.
Right.
Just to signpost the episode a little bit, we are going to start with a little plot synopsis, then describe our characters and how they change, and then we'll finish off with a themes analysis of J.R. Tolkien and his political views on anarchy and hierarchy, followed by a discussion on environmentalism and how the movie changes discussion of this theme compared to the book, and finally on class politics in the Two Towers, specifically with the orcs.
Yeah, so let's start off with not everyone's favorite part of the show, but something that's pretty important. Let's talk about the plot and structure of the Two Towers, because the main difference between Two Towers and Fellowship is that Two Towers is when the Fellowship gets broken up into three groups. We have three plot lines that run throughout the movie. The last chapter of the first book, if I recall correctly, is called The Breaking of the Fellowship. When Frodo and Sam are betrayed by Boromir at the end of the first movie, they decide, you know, they're going to be men going their own way, or small folk going their own way. They can't trust the men. They're going to just rely on themselves to complete the ring quest. So one plot line that we have is Frodo, the ring bearer, his gardener Sam, and Gollum, a hobbit, a former ring bearer who has been corrupted by the ring into this grotesquerie, guiding them to Mordor. Yeah, Gollum is kind of like a murder Virgil, guiding them through this horrible world to Mordor. Meanwhile, the other two hobbits, Merry and Pippin, meet the Ents, who are the giant talking tree people in Fangorn Forest, and they spend the whole movie trying to encourage these giant tree people to join the fight against the Dark Lord. Most of this plotline is them talking with trees. There's a lot of delayed gratification. This is, hold on, you ready for this? This is the edging plotline before they bust a nut or acorn and destroy Isengard.
Boo.
Meanwhile, our three non-Hobbit members, so Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn.
Let's refer to these days like the Warhammer characters.
Yeah, there we go.
Because you wouldn't want to do a Frodo and Sam Warhammer campaign or anything.
I'm just imagining a Warhammer nerd buying a Gollum model and just starting to obsess over the paint job and just start calling it my precious as he paints Gollum just so.
Yeah, roll for anxiety split personality.
Roll with disadvantage. You're having a manic episode as Gollum.
Roll with advantage for manic episode. This is the depressive episode you got to watch out for.
Yeah. So yeah, the Warhammer pieces. These are probably the parts of the movie that you remember the best. Their whole plot line is to get the riders of Rohan, the horse lords.
Well, let's start from the beginning. For me, it was the most compelling part of the movie for sure. You get to see Aragorn do rangering. So he's listening to the ground and estimating where the Uruk-hai are. He's like, they're speeding up. I can tell from listening to the rock. And there's so many great landscape shots here. Ben and I were laughing. There's so many shots where they pan a helicopter out and our three heroes are running across the mountain with the majestic music. And it's this majestic mountain and music and it hits so good. But when you do zoom out that much, you do get a sense for how slowly they're traveling on foot.
Our epic fantasy heroes are running a 15-minute mile and we're like, hell yeah.
They get a lot of ground to cover.
And yes, so first they're tracking the hobbits. Then eventually they get entangled with this plot line around the horse lords of Rohan. Essentially, the plot is that they need to make the king believe in himself. But they need to get the Rohirrim, which I believe is the plural, to join the fight against the Dark Lord. Because, like we said on our first episode, there's this fatalistic streak. Some people think the war is already lost, and the horse lords think that they stand alone. And this is about forging an alliance to fight the war to end all wars against the Dark Lord. And the climax of the film, as we've already alluded to, is of course the Battle of Helm's Deep, where the Rohirrim retreat into their mountain fortress. And they're going to do an epic last stand against an army of orcs. And this battle scene is so fucking good.
It's a bit long.
Not as long as the one in the next movie, Giordano.
This is not too long of a battle. It's perfectly fine.
What I like about it is you can imagine what Helm's Deep looks like. You know exactly what it looks like. It has a causeway. It has a big wall. It has an outer courtyard. It has an inner courtyard. They built a fucking model and a set. And a couple weeks ago, we were roasting the Star Wars prequels because they just have the Battle of the Windows screensaver where we have two armies of toys smash into each other on a bland featureless plane. But it's Lord of the Rings. It has texture. It has substance. It is real. And the battle has the phases where we got the archers going after the guys with the ladders. We're fighting melee on the walls. We're kicking down the ladders. There's a suicide bomber at one point. There's an explosion. And then we're holed up at the smallest room of the keep. It's awesome. So that is the plot of The Two Towers, the plot summary of this fucking 4-hour movie.
My question is, why do you hate Faramir and why did you ignore that entire plot line?
Faramir, oh yes, the whole plot line in Osgiliath.
It's a bit of a lull.
Yeah, okay. What's everyone's least favorite part of this movie? What's everyone's lull moment?
There's a couple for me, yeah. The first are the Aragorn dream sequences.
Mm-hmm.
The first dream sequence I could deal with. The second dream sequence, I'm like, okay, I'm done.
I quite literally fell asleep. It was an immersive experience for me.
It was a honk shoe fest here last night. Ben was seeing Galadriel.
Important parts of the movie, but not exactly the most exciting, especially considering I think the rest of it actually moves with a decent pace for like a 3-hour extended version.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are definitely, they're just not very exciting.
Well, tell us about the Faramir scenes. So what happens there is he captures Frodo and Sam and Gollum, and he just kind of contemplates whether or not to free them.
He becomes aware that they have the Ring of Power and mm-hmm. that they traveled with his brother Boromir, but of course they did not see the finale of the Fellowship of the Ring film, so they don't actually know what's up.
You learn a bit about Boromir as well, like his mission. There's a flashback that tells you that Denethor was like, Boromir, get me this ring.
Sean right. Bean gets screen time in the extended edition?
I think it's actually one of the most effective extended or additional scenes out of all the extended editions. It makes Boromir much, much more empathetic. I think he comes across really well.
Right, right. Well, remind me, what is Boromir experiencing in that scene? He's very empathetic for his brother. He's supportive. He's like, don't worry about father. I know he's insane about his preference for me.
Everyone loves Boromir, basically. And the dad, which I guess is what we see in Faramir's eyes. It's his father's love, but Boromir gets it all.
And I think it's important that we see in those flashbacks that Boromir isn't soaking up the adulation. He doesn't see himself as the golden child. Like, he has a lot of love for his brother. He tries to,
right,
he's boosting his brother up to his dad. He's, yes, talking about
it was all Faramir's doing,
right? He's reluctant to even go to Rivendell because he wants time to actually be in Gondor. He comes across as a good brother and a dutiful son, and I think it gives more context to him, a little bit more of a three-dimensional than just like he wants power or he thinks it's, he's just corrupted.
Absolutely.
I think it really adds a lot of depth to it.
Yeah, and I actually think, like you said, it's probably the best extended edition scene for sure, because this movie doesn't have a death. We do get people coming back to life, though.
We're going the other way.
Yeah, we're going the other way. It almost makes you feel like Boromir dies again, because you're like, oh, he was actually like a good guy, not just this power-hungry human that was...
Giordano, you completely ignored Haldir.
Haldir, right. Hamling? No respect for Hamling? Yeah,
Hamling?
Okay.
Who's Hamling?
He's the guy who gets his face bitten off by the warg.
And Theodred, Theoden's son, also dies. He gets injured off-screen, and then the funeral's on-screen also, I think, extended edition. Some song singing and flower on grave.
Oh, man, there's a song in the extended edition?
That one is also wild to me that it's not in the original. I think this is definitely the movie that benefits just in whole from the extended, because it is the shortest one. But yeah, Eowyn singing the... It's in the, like, traditional language of the Rohirrim.
Mm.
So it's not in English, and it's the funeral rites, basically.
Man,
it's,
yeah, critical support and respect for Peter Jackson for including not only the Elvish, but also the Rohirrim's traditional language. We got two pretend languages in this film. Yeah, I will say, any part of this movie that's corny or hokey, I think is there because some sex criminal Hollywood producer insisted we needed to make this a little bit more like a movie. We can't have the tree lore like we did in the original books. And we'll talk more about the tree lore, but I'm thinking in particular the corny aspects of it. A few jump out at me. Number one, we got the fact that the Battle of Helm's Deep was one chapter, not at the end of the books, and the book is just expanded to be the third act climax. I do love the battle, but there's stuff that got dropped so that they could blow it up Helm's Deep. Number two, for hokiness, Gandalf's tagline that was clearly written for a movie trailer, "The battle for Helm's Deep is over. The battle for Middle-earth is about to begin." Come on, man. You didn't need to say that. Whatever happened to show, don't tell. And then, of course, the most egregious movification of the source material is like, we gotta bring a little levity to this thing. We got six characters talking about how hope is lost. I get it. This is the dark one. So the comedy we're gonna get is Gimli, son of Gloin, is just the fucking zinger generator, and it stinks.
Single-handedly trying to bring back dwarf tossing. That's what they were all about. They're like, this movie is going to be a cultural hit.
Yeah. Windsor loves that scene.
Our hometown listener has a yearly dwarf toss at one of the strip clubs.
And it went to the Supreme Court of Canada.
Yeah.
A free speech issue.
The woke mob is trying to take away our things.
Did they defend that?
I think they still do it. And I know the local paper interviewed the people who come. People travel from across the country. There were people who flew from Alberta. And to give you an idea of how bleak it is, the dwarf toss happens on Christmas Day.
What?
Oh my God. You don't have a family to be with. Jesus.
You're going to go to the strip club for the dwarf toss.
Yeah, one guy's like, oh yeah, I haven't missed it in years. Flew from Alberta to a shitty Ontario border town to go to the dwarf toss at the strip club.
This is the saddest thing. Oh, I regret bringing this. I knew it was risky bringing it up, but Jesus, it's a sad turn.
I'm Sam Katzman here at Leper's Lounge in Broyle. A lot of chatter about the dwarf toss. We get 35 calls a day of people interested on where to buy tickets. It's going to be a packed house. Its home is in Windsor, Ontario. It's a competitive event, and there will be a trophy given to the winner. Our performer is a professional and a celebrity. He has been on TV, he has toured with Motley Crue, he has performed at different Elvis acts. His safety is always our priority.
Yeah, so in Fellowship, Gimli is ashamed to be tossed, right? No one tosses a dwarf. And then in this one, he does implore Aragorn to throw him, but he is shameful about it. He says, don't tell the elf.
Yes. Yeah, anything else you want to add on plot and structure before we move on to characters?
Yeah, what are your favorite scenes?
I like the part at the Black Gate where Frodo and Sam get up there. It shows like how big of a challenge they are taking on, and they didn't really know what they were getting into. And they're like just two hobbits, and there's like an army streaming in, and Sam's still trying to do it until Gollum stops them. He's the voice of reason there.
Right. That's so true, because so much of this movie, it's like they're being carried along as they swing vine to vine. And that is just, they're like, well, I guess we'll just go to the gate. And they get there and they're like, oh yeah, we can't do this. You know, we have to turn around.
It turns out gates, and this is true, are made to impede movement. It is a barrier that you ran towards.
Yeah, and they're like, we'll just run in after the army, you're right. And Gollum has to be like, no. He's worried about the ring getting captured by the Dark Lord himself, right?
He knows it's a dumb idea.
There's one thing I will say about Helm's Deep, which I know we've gushed over. Tolkien would never have a gunpowder anachronism in his medieval fantasy. Gunpowder hadn't come to Europe in the medieval period yet. And I know, whatever, it's a fantasy universe. You can do whatever the fuck you want. You just need to give it a cool name, like George R.R. Martin does. It's called fucking Dragonfire or whatever. Tolkien would never, but it does let them blow up a model and it looks real cool.
Looks fantastic. You get the Olympic torch as they, Legolas can't bring him down.
Yes.
My favorite scene is actually one of the buildups. I actually love the scene when they are in the armory and it's them complaining, Gimli commenting like, you know, there's, what is it, two yes. winters? And it's when they have this emotional, like, this is hopeless, and Aragorn's like, well, then I will die as one of them.
Yeah.
Where they break from Elvish into English and everyone's like, oh, they're talking about us.
And how we're all gonna die, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I actually love that scene. It's like the really emotional crux of setting up the emotional stakes of it. I wouldn't have minded if they didn't pull the elf army out of their ass and they had just stuck with the 300 men against 10,000, because there are no elves that show up in the book, and I think it takes away a little bit, though, like I said, we love Haldir. His death also, tragic, heartbreaking.
And it raises the stakes, right? Because elves can't age to death, but they can be murdered to death. So it's like an even bigger sacrifice than the child soldiers that the Rohirrim are using.
Or you can just take that boat out of here.
There's a lot of coaching scenes in Helm's Deep from Aragorn and the rest of them being like, listen, this is a game of inches. We got him. I know we're down, but it's not about who's down. It's about who comes up at the end. You know, he's trying to pump the troops up.
Oh yeah. I was stoked as fuck. My favorite scene is that final scene when he convinces Théoden King to ride out, and the exact line is, fell deeds awake, now for wrath, now for ruin and a red dawn. I was fucking fired up, man. I was like a boomer dad watching football. I was like, oh, big third down here, and I stood up and started pacing. Let's move on to some of our characters, and I have a lore question here for Radu. So yeah, we get all the same characters from the first film and more, and one of the new characters we get, as Giordano mentioned, Gandalf gets resurrected. He was Gandalf the Grey, and now he is Gandalf the White. Where's the next gray wizard? I'm not sure. I think they'd be turned into a remote position. But I feel like the movie does a not great job of explaining how or why Gandalf is resurrected as Gandalf the White. He's one of several Jesus-style figures in the film. So let me ask our resident lorehead, what's the deal with Gandalf's resurrection? Go for that one first, Radu.
So Gandalf is part of a race of, or maybe not a race, a being that cannot be technically killed, even though he can be disembodied, just like Sauron. So I think when he is sent back as Gandalf the White, it's a sign from the creator of the universe that Saruman kind of messed up as the previous white wizard. He erred in his mission to support the people of Earth. The wizards aren't supposed to seek power themselves. They're supposed to help the Middle Earth people to make wise decisions, etc. They're sent there against Sauron. So Saruman has really abandoned his mission, and when Gandalf is sent as the White, he's sent back to fix that mess up.
I always found it was very interesting that they draw this weird distinction between like who they actually are, because even in the movie they allude to it when he says, I am Saruman, or as he should, Saruman as he should be, because they make it more clear in the book that he is Saruman, he just now is Gandalf. They kind of confuse that a little bit more than the film just sort of implies, they brought me back, gave me a promotion,
right?
The book sort of made it seem a little bit more complicated.
It's crazy that the wizards are a separate race. I thought they were just humans who got, you know, they went to magic school and they got good at magic. It's wild that they're like interdimensional alien beings or whatever.
Kind of class of being as Sauron. So they're kind of like angels more than Jesus.
What's his power level, Gandalf? Because I feel like that can vary. If he's facing a cave troll, he needs help to beat the cave troll. But if he's facing a Balrog, he could beat him on his own, but only when he's when he's traveling the world.
I don't know. Magic in Middle Earth is pretty ill-defined.
Yeah, is this supposed to be some kind of magic wizard?
Boy, I really hope somebody got fired for that blunder.
He does have one of the three rings of power, one of the three rings that were given to elves. In the Return of the King, they show that he has a ring of fire. And apparently that was a point of contention between Saruman and Gandalf.
Really?
What?
And it was given to him. He got what was the more powerful of the rings, being the Ring of Fire.
Also, Giordano, if we're going to play armchair general, the Balrog, he's faced on a bridge, right? He's able to use the environment. It's a lesson from Batman that Ra's al Ghul taught him. Always be mindful of your surrounding.
Right.
Whereas the cave troll was just in a big room. He took that advantage away.
Yeah, I mean, he fought the Balrog in every dimension.
Oh, right. I forgot that was part of it.
The top of a mountain while falling in a number of circumstances.
Yeah, they had a fucking control group. Let's talk about Flanderize Gimli. And I think I've kind of said everything I need to say, but I find it just undercuts the tone of the movie so much. Because the tone of this movie is meant to be our heroes are on the back foot. It's hopeless. Because one of the final speeches, maybe my second favorite line after the fucking pump up lines from Helm's Deep, is Sam's talk about hope and stories in darkness. So we're supposed to have both of that, the hope and the darkness. And in the lead up to the Battle of Helm's Deep, as the armies are marching, they run the same joke back three times, which is, isn't it funny that Gimli is short and he can't see over the parapet?
My
and
God.
Everybody else is stoic, stern, intense. Maybe they're trying to mask their fear. The rain is falling. They're facing their certain death. And we just have the hack Scottish dwarf. What's going on there? To me, it undercuts it so fucking hard.
But it's nice. But it's just, it's the same thing from Gimli every time we go back to him. There's one moment where he shows emotion when Aragorn comes back.
He's alive!
Where is he? Where is he? Get out of the way! I'm gonna kill him! You are the luckiest, the canniest, and the most reckless man I ever knew. Bless you, laddie.
That's about it from Gimli. Everything else is like, don't!
I didn't mind it as a kid. I gotta say,
yeah.
I was the audience at the time, and maybe this will validate my opinion, but I liked Jar Jar Binks when I was a kid too, because you know what? I was the target market, and I was like, he's funny. Right. And I thought Gimli was funny. And I thought I didn't know the real Gimli from the books. I just knew John Rhys-Davies having a laugh. And I don't hate it. When I think of lines from The Two Towers, like, you'll have to toss me, is right up there for me. So I don't mind it, especially when they're doing the drinking. That is my least favorite of them, I think. Actually, I think it's worse than the box stuff.
So what's he like in the books? What's Gimli's demeanor like in the book? Is he always falling and falling off a horse?
No, he's from the dwarven noble class. He is a proud dwarven nationalist. He does develop profound respect for Legolas. I think the movie understates, and I have a whole bunch of this preps for later. But yeah, he's not a fucking punchline. He's proud. He's noble. Kind of like a lot of these characters.
I don't remember laughing that much in the books. You remember, like, jokes?
You guy with a sense of humor, Tolkien?
I think there are some laugh lines, I think.
Okay. It's a nice combination, these three personalities. You see it throughout time. Gimli, Aragorn, Legolas. Cumtown is kind of made up of these figures as well. Stav is Gimli. Nick is Aragorn, and Adam Friedland is Legolas.
I don't know. You had me until Legolas, Adam Friedland.
That one's tough.
Yeah, let's move on to Gollum. Gollum, who is Loki, the star of the Two Towers. He gets a lot of screen time. And what I love about Gollum in this, right, he's got a split personality. Sometimes he's Smeagol, sometimes he's Gollum. He is a liar. He's perfidious. He's just gross to look at, right? He's pale. He's lanky. He crawls around like some kind of animal. He challenges the binary between human and animal, and he represents the risks of what might happen if Frodo succumbs to the ring's temptation. Because Gollum was a hobbit. He even has really similar eyes to Frodo. They're both this bright blue. They're both big. They don't take up a whole bunch of space on his head. And it's funny because the hobbits are famously these rustic gourmands, and Gollum's been living in a cave for all this time, eating raw fish, but he still maintains aggressive food opinions about the best way to eat a fish, which is live and writhing and wriggly. And he's mortified that Sam the gardener is cooking the fish for a soup. There's a little bit of that hobbit still deep down inside of him.
And I like that the more humanity Frodo shows Gollum, the more time he spends as Smeagol. The more he calls him Smeagol, like his birth name, and treats him as such, Gollum's Smeagolness comes back, I think, a lot more as the movie goes on.
It's definitely emphasized, though, the more dignity he's treated with. You only get that split in the personality, and there's that first scene where you get the sort of flopping camera angle to give you that perspective of being a dialogue after he uses Smeagol's name the first time. So, mm-hmm. It's actually like what kind of creates the split again, because it had just been Gollum.
It seems like Frodo kind of awakens this part of his personality. That's when he starts going back and forth. And when he has that moment where that realization of being like Smeagol, you know, it's just nice to see Frodo maybe see himself in Gollum and treat him with dignity. And Frodo's got two great relationships in the movie, him and Sam and him and Gollum. He's really the only person who has a relationship with the Smeagol.
I wanted to go see the movie Precious. I thought it was a Gollum spinoff.
And I, let me tell you something, I had the same reaction to Precious that I did to the Rings of Power.
He's in the post-credit scene.
I just thought it was interesting. I love this fantasy world because you do have these races who are different, and the hobbits are awesome. The way that they act, we talked about this in our first episode, but they have different wants and needs than a human. So for example, like if a human gets a hold of the Ring of Power, like Isildur and like the other people, they want to dominate. Their first goal is to raise an army and use it to kill and dominate. Whereas when a hobbit gets the ring, their goal and attitude is to become a gooner, go inside of the middle of a mountain and like beat off with the ring for 800 years and eat raw fish, just full goon cave. What happens if an elf gets the ring? What do they want to do? Do you know?
They're already immortal. What could they want?
But I love that aspect of the movie, that as long as it's in a hobbit's hands, it kind of ends up staying safe in a way.
Gollum did keep it secret, keep it safe.
Yeah, true. He held it for a long time. He kind of made a sacrifice like Frodo's making.
And again, I think I quoted this line in the first episode where Frodo says to Gandalf, it's a pity Bilbo didn't kill him. And Gandalf says, no, it was pity that stayed his hand. And I think this very encouraging, heartwarming, hopeful message of Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings, that we all have our part to play. The simple country gourmands are going to be the ones who save the universe. And even though Gollum sadly fails his test, because in the final moment, he fails his arc. He does not grow. He tries to get the ring one last time in the volcano and dies with it thanks to his obsession. But even fucking Gollum has a role to play in the quest to save the world. Like it or not, they can't get to Mordor without this little goblin.
Right? Like in the end, Frodo does not complete the quest. He says no.
Mm-hmm.
He does the same thing that those who came before him did. So it's not just even getting there. Smeagol's the only one getting this across the line. You know?
Yeah. He's got the clutch gene. What can you say?
That fullback you're handing the rock to on golden inches.
Yeah. And I guess we can talk very briefly on Frodo.
These movies all get a bad rap for obviously not doing great on the Bechdel test. We noticed there was a full-on conversation between two women at the beginning of this movie.
Not about a man.
But they're not named, unfortunately. Or maybe they're named in the credit, but they certainly aren't in the scene.
It's the so we had that young child and her mother.
Yeah.
That's almost a conversation, sure.
I'm pretty sure it's a young boy, unless you're talking about the little baby child as well, who barely speaks, but
he's too big for you.
We didn't really use this language at the time, but I really do feel like Frodo is non-binary coded. to the extent that Frodo is gendered at all, I think you'd have to make a case for it,
mm-hmm.
right? He is referred to as Mr. Frodo, but maybe that's just because we don't really have a great addresser. Like, I think it's Muckster, right? Is the
all right, Muckster Frodo.
I think they go to the novels to explain that the ring does sort of rob him a little bit of his desire for the more normal aspects of life, including like, well, I think it's kind of implied, but like sex and a family.
Mm-hmm.
They really contrast that with Sam and Rosie.
Right.
It is something that they kind of touch on, actually, where they kind of imply as part of what he had to give up, his even ability, I think, to have those sort of interpersonal relationships.
Yeah. Sam, in the epilogue, he's going to have a family and do normal family things. And Frodo is going to leave Middle Earth entirely, right? Okay, so the first theme that I think is going to be the most fun to talk about is a political one. We talked a little bit about J.R.R. Tolkien's political views. We called him maybe something of an anarcho-primitivist, the way that he hates technology and industry and clearly thinks that modernity was a mistake. I wonder if there's something in his life that could have made him feel this way, perchance. Maybe something in France or Flanders.
As a professor, maybe had an issue with the kids listening to tiny gramophones and forgetting they had them on them. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a great quote that I found. Don't tell me if it's apocryphal because I want it to be true, but it's allegedly from one of Tolkien's letters where he said, "My political opinions lean more and more towards anarchy," parentheses, philosophically understood, meaning the abolition of control and not whiskered men with bombs. The most improper job for any man is bossing other men. Not one in a million is fit for it, and least of all, those who seek the opportunity. And I think that this comes through in Lord of the Rings so hard. We'll focus mostly on Théoden King in this one, who needs to be fucking gentle parented by Aragorn into doing his duty as king. But you could look at someone like Denethor also is not a great boss slash leader. And the person who does make the great king is Aragorn, the guy who doesn't want it. He just wants to fucking range in the forest, protecting the innocent and doing his ranger things. And he's the one who can be a good king. But the contempt for bosses, that's part of the anarcho-Tolkienist thought, I think super comes through with Théoden.
I've never thought about it in that way, but it is interesting because we do see, like, I actually would contest that, like, I don't think he really is their gentle parenting, because we do see so much of Théoden rejecting Aragorn's advice. They even say, like, going to Helm's Deep, the whole thing that this movie kind of hinges around, is a mistake.
Yep.
And if we, what do we know about Rohirrim from the first fucking 5 seconds we see them? They're horse lords. And they're like, what if we put ourselves behind a wall? It really is, in terms of like a strategy, not exactly playing to their strengths. And, you know, where was Théoden when the fucking Westfold fell?
Yeah.
Like, well, my guy was getting whispered sweet nothings in his ear from a guy named Wormtongue. Like, come on, figure it the fuck out.
Mistake number one, hiring Grima Wormtongue. We're not going to repeat the same joke about names in Tolkien, but the most obviously villainous character in this film.
Yeah. Well, he had the power of magic.
Yes.
This is hypnosis or something. But yeah, you're right. When he comes out of the fucking stupor and he's like, where was Gondor when Westfall fell? I'm going to send for their help. It's like, dude, where were you? Like, you were fucking zonked
out. Asleep at the wheel.
Yeah. Don't be so prideful.
Clawned out in your chair. And we see he gets bummed out. He has a depressive episode in the hall in Helm's Deep. Right before he gets pumped up by Aragorn, where he's like, yep, it's lost. It's done. It's over. Théoden King bounces between it's so over, it's never been more over, to we are so back. Only when he gets the coaching or gentle parenting or whatever of the three Warhammer figures.
I think it ties in wonderfully with the themes, though, because Théoden, you're talking about him as ineffective, as someone who has failed in his stewardship of his people. Mm-hmm. And it's played out very literally with the death of his son. His line is ended. Eowyn and Éomer are not his kids. They're his niece and nephew. So his line is actually ended. And if you actually think about a lot of the decisions he makes in that the next 24 hours of coming out of this magical stupor where his son has also died, it's a lot of grief. And I think that's actually present in the book a little bit. I think it's present in some of the extended scenes. But I do think that it contrasting when you look at the hope that our Warhammer trio bring, that is Aragorn's whole thing, is that he's bringing hope to men in general. And it's through all this, what you would call gentle parenting, but all this hopefully growth that Théoden actually shows between then and when he dies, is that he's leaving Rohan in better hands, probably, in Éowyn and Éomer's hands. I believe it's Éomer becomes king. And I think it works quite well in that sense, although I'm definitely coming down harder on my opinion of Théoden as a king after this. I've been letting him slide for too long.
Same. I think you're right, because we see Wormtongue whispering in his ear, and then Gandalf whispers in his ear, and then Aragorn is whispering in his ear. It seems like he's
very suggestible.
Exactly.
Very impressionable king.
I mean, there was some magic, but it was just a little bit, I think.
But just to wrap up this thing about Tolkien's own politics around anarchy and hierarchy, we do get a sense that all the men kings in this movie, anyone who's in charge is kind of a dick. In the extended edition, we do see the King of Gondor, who doesn't have Wormtongue whispering in his ear, and he's kind of just as much of a dick, in a way, to his sons.
I do need to issue a correction. He's the regent of Gondor,
Jordano. Sorry, yeah.
Steward.
The steward.
Fuck! You're right. Damn, I got. And what is the ideal for Tolkien? It's the fucking Shire. We don't see any mayor of the Shire, I don't believe. We don't see any bosses in the Shire. You can't tell me what to do. It's La Dolce Vita, man. This is Italy. There's no orders here.
That's why anarchy is so popular with those bomb-throwing Italians. You know?
Yeah, the mustaches he was talking about in the quote. Yeah, he was thinking about a fucking Giuseppe or somebody. If the Shire is La Dolce Vita, what would it be like if all of those hobbitses were Italians?
Yeah, I mean, we did talk on our last episode about, you know, how much they love jewelry to begin with. So the obsession over the ring makes a lot more sense. But, you know, maybe they could say stuff like, yes, so we've had an affair, but what about the dalliances and the liaisons and just the tipsies?
Yeah, there is a lot of Italian aspects to the Shire, because J.R.R. Tolkien portrays these parochial country folk that are feuding with each other over nothing, you know? It's the Bagginses and the Saxville Bagginses. Maybe they're like a family that's fallen out over a recipe or something, about whether or not to add certain spices to the sauce, and their names are something like, you know, Bagginatelle da Sacavilla. Or it goes a very dark way, and instead of this constant feuding over boundary lines and recipes or whatever, the Bagginatelle da Sacavilla just firebomb Bag End. It's an end to the feud entirely.
The enmity of the Mezzogiorno with the food, I think, is the best ones. You know, you got the potatoes, boil them, mash them, roll them in the gnocchi. Potatoes.
Potatoes. Anything else Italian Shire that we can make fun of? Italian jokes. They're horny. They love food. Any other Italian stereotypes we can
engage
in?
They love their mother.
They love their mother. Ooh. The only thing that makes Italian Shire not work is that there are no women in Lord of the Rings, which means there are no mothers, which means you can't have Italian Shire. That's actually the only thing that stops it from happening.
Right. Yeah. We never hear Bilbo talk about his mother or Frodo talk about their mother. Maybe someone with a better understanding can explain anarchy, because I've had someone explain it to me before where I think people assume it means like, oh, that's libertarian philosophy. But what they don't like is hierarchy, right? They don't like human hierarchy.
Yeah. And Tolkien probably has some confused politics, because this is a guy who was Catholic. They love hierarchy and ranks. And he was so Catholic that when the... How Catholic was he? He was so Catholic that when they stopped doing the Latin Mass, he would keep going to Mass, but still say the Latin, because of course he would. He's a language dork. So this guy who's going to Mass in Latin is writing in his personal business about, like, I don't like bosses. I don't like being told what to do or telling people what to do. Yeah, I'm sure his politics are, like, a little bit confused, but anarchism is a big topic because there's all sorts of different flavors of anarchist. And I think I'm just going to dodge the question with a joke. What does a leftist hate more than anything else in the entire world? A slightly different kind of leftist.
So the people who don't like hierarchies don't have an organized belief system, I guess. It's easily succinct.
Just read the bread book, Giordano. Read The Conquest of Bread. That's to understand anarchism.
Okay.
But yeah, let's talk environmentalism, which we did already talk about in our first episode. But this is where we get it in its most distilled form. Because we got... Well, first off, we use the environmentalism to characterize Saruman as a pure villain. Who would say the line, "We will destroy the forests," other than a mustache-twirling villain? Very, very black and white Tolkienism there.
Very on the nose, yeah.
To industry. To industry. But I do want to quibble a little bit with the movie ends versus the book ends. So first off, we dropped a lot of really quality tree lore. There were some songs that got cut. There were some poems that got cut. There's a whole story that they talk about a little bit about the Ents looking for the Ent wives that is in the movie. Because he says, like, tell me if you see any Ent wives in the Shire. But they have a whole backstory about how there are no lady trees. And in the same way that, like, the third age is ending. What are the Ents going to do without the Ent wives? It is very tragic. And in the book, this is the major, major change. The movie talks about how the Ents move so slowly. This is the delayed gratification plot line. They don't even start talking unless they do it thoughtfully. And it takes them forever to say anything in Entish. Like, Treebeard is not his real name. His Entish name is much, much longer. And in the book, they just decide to join the fight against Sauron through careful, considered, methodical, rational thought. And they're like, this is the right thing to do.
As a moral principle.
As a moral principle that was established through through thinking. And in the movie, they get swindled by a fucking hobbit reverse psychology con man. It's like, oh, you wouldn't like that. That's more of an Entwives idea. But like, they show the trees the destruction of Isengard, and Treebeard's first line is like, I knew these people. They were friends of mine from Nut to Acorn or whatever. And it's such a fucking 21st century Westerner approach to the climate crisis, where it's like, yes, once I am personally affected, hold me back, bro. Yeah. But even the portrayal of the Ents as angry and emotional is very un-Entish. A surprising whiff from someone who clearly has so much love for the source material.
Definitely, I think, an opportunity to try to make it pop on the screen. A reasoned debate leading to the March of the Ents, I guess, just doesn't do it. You want to give the hobbits something to do. You want to make them actually seem a little cunning.
Yeah, I think it makes sense from a translation to movie perspective. Those scenes already kind of drag.
Yeah.
Making them more discussion-based. I don't know if that was the way forward.
Okay, it's the Ent debate, but it's written with snappy Aaron Sorkin style dialogue.
I want the Ent walk and talk.
Yeah, an Ent walk and talk.
It does do a lot of walk and talking, the Ent.
Treebeard is walking. He's giving the... It's like that scene in The West Wing where Martin Sheen is walking up the middle of the National Cathedral cursing out God because God sent a drunk driver to kill Mrs. Landingham. And all he's doing is reading out Clinton-style job statistics, right? As this man is lamenting the death of his surrogate mother figure, he's like, economic growth has stayed steady at 4% for so many quarters. This is what's so pathetic and lib-brained about The West Wing. So what if we had that, but for our Ent walk and talk in Treebeard's deep voice, like 75% of the forest has been lost to make Uruk-hai. Mm-hmm. Barad-dûr expands at a rate of 8% per annum.
Until Sauron's reawakening, sap was up 4% per quarter. For three straight ages.
I serve at the pleasure of the president is one of the things I say
right.
all the time.
I serve at the pleasure of the Entmoot.
Yeah, I would have loved some more tree lore, but you're right. This is another thing. Some Hollywood producer was like, you want a tree song? No. Fuck off.
Harvey Weinstein, literally.
Yeah.
It's funny because I think this is the one that has the best use of the poetry and song that's in the novels. They had in reading Horse and the Rider. Is that the name of it? The one that he's reading as he's getting assistance, donning his armor free. You know, where's the horse and the rider? I think it's the best application of that sort of thing. I think it's another thing that really stands out with Rohan, really feels fleshed out in the lore sense, especially in the extended edition when you do get the funeral scene as well. It adds quite a lot. So it's a shame that they didn't also do that with the Ents and also that sort of simplified, streamlined approach.
Yeah. Okay, we've talked about environmentalism. We've talked about politics. Let's talk about class. Let's keep it going. Bernardo, you should pop off on this. This was your observation.
Yeah, well, I thought the class came up around orcs. I really like the orcs in this movie because they're given a chance to speak to each other, and which I don't think we saw in the first one. They are characterized a lot more. And there are a lot of orc features that I've always really liked, including from like Warhammer, where there's a rule where you have to roll a dice at the beginning of your turn to see if your units, like they're actually stronger than other units like humans, but they will fight each other if you roll badly because they're antisocial creatures.
What's the trait called?
It's called animosity. And we get to see a little animosity in this movie amongst the orcs. Ben and I were thinking that given how Tolkien thinks about romanticizing rural figures, but the orcs are like the urban figures of the 19th century England, some era he's calling back to, because they all have these working class urban accents, and it sounds very funny coming out of them.
They're soccer hooligans, man. They're soccer hooligans with meat cleavers.
It's funny, that's actually how they got the audio for parts of Helm's Deep for the Uruk-hai.
Oh, really?
It was a match, actually, in New Zealand.
Yes, I saw that.
They got to help with the audio for making it sound like an actual mass of people. At halftime, they gave people the chant, and that's what you're hearing is like part of the audio mixing, or like the audio on the Uruk-hai when they're chanting en masse as the battle's about to begin and things like that.
Also, on the topic of class and accents, the elves have a much more elevated and languid accent, especially this motherfucker Haldir, who shows up in Helm's Deep. He sounds like an Oxford-educated Brit. I like to call him a red cloak. because he shows up just to die and his cloak is red. But when I heard him talk, I'm like, he sounds like he should have a commission for the colonies. He should have a pith helmet. He should sip a G&T on a veranda and be the manager of genocide. That's what his accent says.
And I like when, I think Aragorn gives one a hug.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the red cloak. He's like, he gets scared that someone's trying to hug him. Just kind of like a very, again, upper class figure. Yeah. The orcs, they hug it out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
As John said in the last episode, it is funny to hear these orcs speak too, because they use the word menu.
Yes.
Which I don't, that word was around in orc society.
Yeah. I mean, we also see them literally practice cannibal on a raw meat. How many restaurants are they frequenting?
Right. Can you imagine trying to like open up a little like cafe at the bottom of the Barad-dûr, and it's just the worst landlord, fucking terrible tippers.
Well, they need Saruman, right? They need an upper class figure to rule them with an iron fist and be like a dictator. Otherwise, they'll never have the organization to pose a threat to humanity.
Or like a father figure. This is what you're saying, you know? Just imagine an orc hooligan be like, "Oi, bruv, I never know me father. Died in a cannibalism accident he did." There's very little that's as fun as doing a bad British accent. Yeah. Okay, let's move on. If that's all we got on the orcs and their portrayal. I love the idea that we really see in the Two Towers of the collaboration with evil. So Sauron is quite literally a faceless evil. He doesn't got a face. I don't know what to tell you. But he's referred to as the Dark One. There's something elevated and unhuman and supernatural about Sauron. But what's more interesting to me are the people who work for him. And I think the Two Towers is about that. The line that Saruman says about the Two Towers is the collaboration between Tower of Isengard and the Tower of Barad-dûr, right?
Well, sorry. It's Orthanc and Barad-dûr.
Okay. Thank you.
I think, Radu, I'm sorry for jumping on that, Radu. I'm sure you were about to get on that one.
Man, when you open the Wikipedia for the book, The Two Towers, one of the first lines is, "We're not entirely sure which two towers are implied."
Wait, what?
Because five towers are mentioned in the book.
Yeah, but I mean,
no one ever uses that phrase and emphasizes these are the two towers of the Dark Lord.
No.
Hey, that's the name of the movie. Do they ever have one of those?
I don't think so.
I guess not. Wow.
This is what the movie is about. It's the people who work with the faceless malevolence. And we see a bunch of it. We see, of course, Saruman. His manifestation of evil is, of course, industry and modernity. We see it with Grima Wormtongue, who's a lackey for Saruman. And he's going to undercut people who may attempt to fulfill leadership roles.
See it in the southern races.
Yes, and we see it with the Muslimic style people who fight with Sauron. It's a little yikesy.
I was going to say something about Faramir. He also has a scene where he interacts with the Easterlings, I think it was at that point, and then we see the introduction of the Oliphants, favorite Tolkien word, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
But he out loud pontificates on the nature of war and how this person probably maybe just wanted to stay home and chill and didn't really want to go to war and die.
Mm-hmm. Over the corpse of the Southron, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and I mean, Faramir actually is an interesting candidate in that when faced with the choice, he does not falter like his brother does, right? The big reveal is that initially, just like Boromir, he wants to take the ring and use it.
Mm.
But eventually he sees, through a combination of seeing the actions of the hobbits and also hearing that his brother went mad, he makes the right choice, right? He chooses not to meddle with powers that are above his pay grade or whatnot, to trust the pure of heart halflings.
It's funny you use that phrasing because it's actually him not just showing, what does he say? It's not just proving his character, but it's also explicitly going against that weak man in power order, because that's Denethor ordering. It's an explicit order that it should be brought back, that it should be used.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that same, exactly what you were saying, Radu, with the Easterling shot dead. And it's like, he was just following orders, which is funny. It's funny that Faramir's, he's the one who then later follows them again. We'll see in Return of the King, to tragic ends. Obviously not quite for him, but for literally everybody else he's hanging out with. It's a nice little tie-in. And it is one of the climaxes of the film, actually. It's hard to think of it because when you think of the movie, Helm's Deep looms so large, but one of the climaxes with the hobbits is that he finally lets them go. And it's amidst the Nazgul attack attacking the attack on Asgillia. And that is the satisfying moment, I guess, that comes out of Frodo and Sam's half of this movie.
Yeah, and I do love that scene. I know I gave it short shrift in my summary, but the fact that the Gondorians, or whatever they're called, they're not yielding one single inch in this existential battle, because Osgiliath is a fucking ruin. It's a tomb. There's no life there other than the soldiers fighting over the rubble. That is what is left in our desperate last-ditch attempt. So it really makes his decision all that much more powerful, that he's still going to trust the hobbits and let them go.
Osgiliath used to be cool. They had like live music. It was a cool scene happening there before.
How long has it been in ruin for? Because there's not a lot of trash around Osgiliath.
I'm not sure, but I think since the Great War began again, when Sauron showed himself and was starting to amass armies again, it's a pretty critical choke point on the route to assaulting Gondor. So it's like Sauron moving a piece there and preparing for the final big battle.
If only Sauron could come up with some remedy for a last-minute cavalry charge when all looks bleak. That seems to be the main move that our heroes use.
Hey, man.
Boiled again.
Yeah.
Tolkien loves his eucatastrophe, and that's one of the reasons it hits great, because you really do feel like, even though you know Gandalf's like, you know, yo, what's up? I'm going to be back in like 5 days. You do forget watching it. You forget, and then it's like, oh, hell yeah, Gandalf shows up. He brings Éomer, and it's such a satisfying moment. The charging down the hill always kind of bothered me, because it's some of the CGI that I think looks the worst in it, as they pour down the hill at like an impossible angle.
Very steep hill.
Looks great.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say, I call this our phantom theme, in that it's a theme that should be there but isn't, is friendship between Legolas and Gimli. And I have a few just sections of Tolkien to read. In the first book, this is from Fellowship, when they're in the Mines of Moria, Gandalf says, "Those were happier days when there was still close friendship at times between folk of different races, even between dwarves and elves." "It was not the fault of the dwarves that the friendship waned," said Gimli. "I have not heard that it was the fault of the elves," said Legolas. "I have heard both," said Gandalf, "and I will not give judgment now. But I beg you two, Legolas and Gimli, at least to be friends and to help me. I need you both." So this is something that I don't think came fully out in the films, which is this racial animosity between dwarves and elves. I think it's there a little bit, but this was supposed to be a huge deal. And then towards the end of Return of the King, it might even be in one of the appendices, we have stuff like, "Gimli Goyne's son is renowned, for he was one of the 9 walkers that set out with the ring, and he remained in the company of King Elessar," that's Aragorn's name, right, "throughout the war. He was named Elf Friend because of the great love that grew between him and Legolas, son of King Thranduil." And there's another one, just for good measure. "We have heard tell that Legolas took Gimli Gloin's son with him because of their great friendship, greater than any that has ever been between elf and dwarf."
Oh.
And instead we get buddy cop, "I've killed 19. It's supposed to be a friendship that transcends centuries of racial animosity. And they're like, but what if they did bants instead?
And I feel like there's room for like a little bit of bants there, but you hear that again and it's like, wow, it really would have been nice. Take out like 3/4 of the bants and just turn it into like maybe even like an actual sort of moment of friendship, even if it's just the helping each other in the battle in a more direct way, more emotional way. We got nothing of that. And it is a real shame, because that last passage, just to make it really clear, is him taking Gimli across the sea to live forever together.
Yeah.
They're not just going on a road trip. They're going to live together forever as friends. And yeah, it's nice for them.
Dope.
I'm happy for them.
I'd love to know why there's so much enmity between elves and dwarves. Yeah, the only other thing was the tone. Did we cover everything?
I feel like we hit everything we need to hit.
I mean, I didn't correct you on all the shit you got wrong about Warhammer, but that's fine. The orc thing, yeah, animosity is only in fantasy. It was never a thing in the Lord of the Rings battle game. It's called stupidity in the old world. It's funny, actually, fantasy, which was their previous flagship thing, died, obviously, about 10 years ago. I'm not sure if you guys knew, but it was killed off as a setting. They had the end of the world took place, and then they spun off from that and created a new fantasy game, which still exists.
Oh, wait, you're serious. They ended fantasy. Oh, yeah. I thought you were fantasy, like, fantasy's ends, dead.
No, dead Warhammer fantasy. Warhammer fantasy ended with the actual end of the world. The like chaos gods win and destroy the world, and that's what creates the new game. But then, and part of the reason they killed it off, apparently, and I'm not sure this is 100% truthful, but my understanding is at the time that they killed fantasy, the Space Marines individually outsold the entire fantasy line. Mine, but I believe so did Boxes of Burakai. And I believe it's Two Towers rather than Fellowship of the Ring that popularized it, mainly because it was the fully armored that I think really sold, and before that they were just in metal blisters for the guys from like Avon Hen. But then they came out with plastic lines. Yeah, apparently I outsold the entire fantasy line just because Urukai were so fucking cool looking. People were like, hell yeah, you made that sword with a rectangular edge. And that's all we needed, apparently, and people loved it. So yeah,
they're cleavers, man. They ain't even swords. Yeah. Those are butchers.
Blunt. Tell me, how would these Lord of the Rings Warhammer battles work? Because Warhammer is two armies that face each other. It seems like a lot of times when I go into the store, they would have staged one of the fights from the movie. And I don't know if that's just to get people in or if it's you're actually like, remember that scene in Fellowship where they meet on that hill, the Nazgûls?
Weathertop.
That was the scene that was staged at the Games Workshop.
It's supposed to be like a tactical strategy game rather than like a big pitch battle thing. So the rules were set up definitely so you could play skirmishes so that you could do a fairly large number of units or models. But ones like that with a Weathertop or Balin's Tomb, they were custom scenarios that they would publish rules for. It would obviously be typically the different sort of win scenarios. I did play a couple of them. They're fun. I did largely just the pitch battle stuff because it took me a while to actually get the Fellowship set because it's all expensive shit.
Let's talk very, very briefly about the tone and style of the movie. I feel like we did talk about tone and style in our first episode, but yeah, it's filmed in real life, so it looks like real life. They use CGI for the things that they have to CGI. If Peter Jackson had the time and money, I'm sure he would have tried to genetically engineer and clone an Oliphant, but the fucking Henry Weinsteins of the world wouldn't let the boys play.
Henry Weinstein? Who's Henry?
Sorry.
He's one of the brothers, I guess, at Miramax.
Well,
Harvey?
Harvey. There we go. Yeah. Henry Weinstein. Fuck.
Maybe he is the other brother.
Yeah.
There's another one.
Harvey Weinstein wouldn't let the boys play and have fun. But no, it looks awesome. Minimal CGI. Amazing shots using, I don't know, like a crane or a helicopter or something very high up. So you get a sense of the scale of the mountains and plains and rugged crags of New Zealand. In terms of tone, this is the dark one, right? It's the middle one. It's the Empire Strikes Back of the trilogy. Every trilogy has a dark middle one. That's the three-act structure of the three movies things. But I think the one thing that stands out most about Two Towers is the fact that our Fellowship is entirely fragmented, which means that we have three stories in parallel, which increases the suspense. I mean, yeah, you could know what happens because you read the fucking books or whatever, but the fact that it's three stories all in one, and there's a lot of payoff at the end with the ends with the battle with, I mean, hell, the big flying Nazgul scene with Frodo is pretty tight where he stares down the fucking dragon.
I think in general, they also did a really good job like switching between those scenes. They gave them room to breathe and it wasn't just flashing between different settings. It was just right. I was just watching it and it was like, that struck me. It was, you get like a solid 10 minutes sometimes in a particular setting and it was good.
I think it's a huge improvement over the books where dividing it between all of the stuff that happens with Aragorn and them versus everything with Frodo and Sam in the back half. Mm-hmm. Come on, man. You couldn't have figured out how to like interlace these chapters?
Yeah, I mean, there is no Merry and Pippin Isengard thing. That's told retroactively after it happens. The Gandalf, Aragorn, the other guys, they come upon Merry and Pippin in a flooded Isengard and they're just like chilling. They're like smoking tobacco or whatever. They're like, hey, we found some tobacco here. And they describe everything that happened more. Yeah, and I would say along with the darkness, we had a good laugh because there's like five or six different characters who say it's hopeless or there's no hope. Just kind of cards on the table telling the audience how to feel.
They say that it is hopeless.
Along with this, I would also say there's a lot of non-toxic masculinity in the Lord of the Rings. A lot of men weeping, a lot of men hugging, and you love to see it.
There's no women in the movie. They gotta hug someone, you know?
In fact, the one woman who is trying desperately to hug Aragorn real bad, Aragorn's like, no, I'm good.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even mention there's a stupid fucking love triangle in this one that I don't care about. It's part of the bit that I bell
sleep. Wormtongue?
No.
Well, he plays his part.
Yeah, more great shots of New Zealand, and because the characters are split up, you see different areas. You get to see a spooky swamp, which looks great. It looks like a real swamp where they've just adjusted the colors to make it look yellow and gray in it. And more of them, yeah, running on the mountaintops we mentioned. Good New Zealand again. It's nice that they just pick this one part of the world to film at. Everything is happening in this world. Yeah. Whereas I'm thinking like Game of Thrones where they film all over the world.
Yeah, we can make the compare and contrast between this movie and this franchise and the Star Wars prequels where they CGI'd a fucking diner. Peter Jackson said, find me a spooky swamp. He said, find me plains, find me mountains.
The CGI diner, yeah.
Yeah, so let's transition to our closing thoughts here. The Two Towers is, in my humble people opinion, not as good as Fellowship, which I still think is the best one. But I think it has a lot of really interesting parts. And I love the fact that it's a movie about hope. The first time I read Lord of the Rings, this book, The Two Towers, was after I had been hit by a car and had broken my wrist. And then a whole bunch of other cascading bad things happened in my life. So much so that Sean, who we've roasted on the pod before, Sean compared me to the main character in It's a Wonderful Life. He couldn't remember the title of the movie, but he was like, you know that like black and white movie where there's a guy and like bad things happen and he thinks of killing himself? That's like you, man.
Jesus Christ.
But I needed a book about hope, and I picked up The Lord of the Rings. And yeah, man, this book and movie makes me teary and weepy-eyed. It's a movie about how the night is darkest before the dawn. And the actual best part of this movie is Sam's monologue about hero's story. This is like pure distilled Tolkien-y thought about how those heroes and those stories, how could the world ever go back to normal after all that bad stuff has happened? But it did. You can just make it. Because it won't be bad forever. Yeah, it's like clearly a meta commentary on the story that we're reading, because Tolkien's a fucking philologist language nerd, so of course he's going to talk about literature generally. But Sam has this realization that his heroes had all these opportunities to quit, but they didn't. Nevertheless, they persisted. They white-knuckled their way through it to the other side. And I think that is so inspirational and hopeful and good. The next time something catastrophically bad happens in my life, I know exactly what book I'm cracking up. anybody else got closing thoughts to add?
Yeah, it's a really great movie, and I kind of know that because all of my biggest complaints about the movie is the stuff I loved as a kid. The worst stuff in the movie is the stuff you loved as a kid, then maybe it's the right mix.
We will do Return of the King at some point, and we will really try and squeeze as much blood out of this stone as we can, but we're not going to get ahead of ourselves.
We're going to be doing a Hobbit on this series, what's known as a Hobbit.
Pulling a Hobbit, yeah.
Were you going to comment on what it did for like the movie industry or movies in general?
So in a world that I would design, more movies and franchises would look like Lord of the Rings. They would be made by creators who love and respect the source material and do a good job because it's a labor of love. That's the world that we could have had. I'm not going to say that these movies weren't influential. I think they were just influential in the wrong way. We took the wrong lessons, which is we need a franchise. We need to adapt existing IP and like turn it into a cash grab, but we're going to do it as shitty and corporate and capitalist cost-cutting measure as possible. I think the much more influential movie franchise from this time that does color how movies are now is the fucking Star Wars prequels. Of you're going to get CGI slop is what you're going to get. I don't think they're still making movies like Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, aside from maybe Game of Thrones.
Didn't they film them all three at once?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, I think that's a good move also, because then they really invested in the whole story as it was and didn't wait for audience or critic feedback to optimize the second and third versions before.
Yes, you can't feed data into the algorithm and be like, we didn't get a lot of memes out of the first movie. We're going to have to add some meme lines.
Yeah, the first one definitely. I mean, one does not simply walk into Mordor. I think they kind of knocked that one out of the park.
This is lazy podcasting, but we could name the memes that Two Towers gave
us. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, the taking the Hobbits to Isengard has got to be right off the top. It's like one of the first scenes.
Yep, tippy top. We have, you have no power here, that Gandalf says. I've seen that in posts before.
They're taking the Hobbits to Isengard is an interesting meme, too, because it's not an advice animal format. It's not like that face when you...
It was a you're the man now, dog. It was a YTMND.
Potatoes is a Lord of the Rings line that comes with potatoes. Boil them, mash them, stick it in the stew. My man Dell, who actually helped us develop some of these takes, producer credit for my buddy Dell on this episode. He had a fully grad school cooked brain take where he's like, you know, I think the potatoes line is foreshadowing what happens to the ring, because it is boiled and then it's mashed in the lava and it's a stew of a sort. In Mount Doom, and I'm like, oh, grad school, not even once, man. Not even once.
Yeah, it was wild. It was like watching a friend who does stand-up comedy, where they're like always trying to think of a bit, but Dell does that for like an academic premise. Yeah.
I did find out it was originally posted on albino black sheep, not YTMND. So that was very much a Flash animation.
Oh, I'm glad that
website
clears things up.
Yeah, well, don't worry about it. So you guys wrote a fucking odd line. Can I read this to you? It's the back of the book jacket for this, and I'm like, I can't imagine giving this information. Imagine you read the first book, you're like, can't wait, what's it say on the back? And The Two Towers, the second book in J.R.R. Tolkien's trilogy, The Lord of the Rings, recounts the further adventures of the companions after the breaking of the Fellowship, the resurrection of Gandalf the White, the rescue of King Théoden, the besieging of the Tower of Orthanc, the betrayal of Frodo and Sam, and the capture of Frodo by orcs. Sorry, did you want to read that? I'm amazed that that's the book jacket. Straight up. I've never seen or read The Two Towers, and they're telling me the resurrection of Gandalf the White, the rescue of King Theoden, the besieging of Orthanc, and the betrayal of Frodo and Sam, and the whole
that's
fucking
a plot
book.
Synopsis. That's not what the back of the book is for.
Right?
That is brutal. Did you read that first?
Yeah.
Jesus, not a spoiler-free back of book cover.
No. You know what's an unfortunate lasting thing from The Two Towers is Palantir, because classic Torment Nexus, where someone was like, wow, that thing sounds awful. What if I created an awful tech company and used the name?
There's a tech company called Palantir?
Yeah.
What do they do?
Yeah.
The worst stuff.
Tech surveillance? Yeah.
Oh, no.
Would you a Palantir in everyone's living room?
Yeah. Yeah. Like truly, truly awful shit.
They do some military contracting as well, don't
you
they?
You betcha.
Yeah.
They might be being used in active war zones. That's my understanding. Maybe.
What the hell? J.R.R. Tolkien was right. Okay. Anarcho-primitivist J.R.R. Tolkien was correct. All right. Well, that has been our Two Towers episode. Thank you so much for joining us. And a huge thank you to our guests, our resident lore heads, Radu and John.
Yes.
Thanks again for having us. Ton of fun.
Thank you.
Anything you guys want to plug? In the past, if we have friends that don't use social media, they'll be like, yeah, the library. The library is good. The education system. I'd like to plug the public education system. Would you like to plug anything?
I'd like to sadly plug Warhammer the Old World, which is their fantasy game. It's back, baby, in POG form, and I'm hooked again. I'm back in.
The one I played. I actually played fantasy and not 40K growing up, because that one was more appealing to me.
And now it's back. They got the new additions.
What faction do you play, John?
My original one is Beastmen. Big fan of the goat guys, but recently I've been playing some, I got my first game of Old World and playing Empire.
Radu, anything to plug?
Yeah, anything to plug?
Like Warhammer?
No, I don't got any plugs. I thought about plugging Rings of Power, but I don't
think the boom! I forgot you liked it.
Wonder if there'll be a next season. Seems like it wasn't universally loved.
Well, it wasn't very expensive to make, so I'm sure they'll just pump up.
Actually, yeah, we always talk about Echoes in the Culture, and we didn't today because we definitely shot our wad on Echoes in the Culture on the first episode. But there is a new animated Lord of the Rings movie coming out this year called The War of the Rohirrim, I believe. And we're going to see John is gazing intently into the camera at me. You know the scene at the end of the movie where Frodo tilts his head forward and the camera pans up like it's the Stanley Kubrick shot to show that the character is going insane? That is how John is looking at me through the Zoom window right now.
I just want to know about the show. I just wanted to know about the show. I hadn't heard the show.
So it's not a TV show. It's a movie. It's an animated movie called The War of the Rohirrim, and Helm Hammerhand, or whatever his name is, he gets a name drop in Two Towers. Yeah, so Brian Cox is going to be playing Helm Hammerhand.
Okay.
Yeah, so anybody have a good Brian Cox impression?
Tell those orcs to fuck off.
Tell those orcs to fuck off.
There it is. Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
What I try to do is Sean Connery doing James Bond, and it comes out as Brian Cox.
Oh, okay. But hey, we're going to get another swing at some Lord of the Rings content. It's based off of information found in an appendix to a book, so they got a lot of rich material to work with. Just do a fucking Silmarillion movie, dude. I know it's the whatever Tolkien Bible, but Rings of Power was based on an appendix. This upcoming animated thing's based on an appendix. Stop adapting appendices.
I think they can't get the rights or something.
It's like, they're being jealously guarded.
Yeah, they don't want to give it away. Sell it for $1 billion.
Yeah, Tolkien would be proud then. You
know? Be happy that his property rights were being enforced. intellectual property rights were benefiting this studio instead of this other studio. He'd love this.
He would have loved the production of the plastics involved to create the Lord of the Rings strategy battle games. You know, it would have made him smile.
Tolkien, the one thing I like about his ideology is that he doesn't even like meritocracies, because he's like, well, the people who are going to want to be boss are going to be also horrible people.
Yeah.
You know, it's even more likely you won't be suitable to be in charge of other people.
Yeah.
But he does believe in the inalienable capability of select few special people.
He does. That he does.
He's very big on that.
Really big on referencing your father as opposed to, to identify yourself.
All right. I think that's all we got for today. We've got our plugs in. Check out Warhammer 40K.
Just gone up. Jeez.
sorry.
I had to bite my tongue earlier when you said the 40K.
Regular Warhammer.
I'm going to let it out now. Thank you. Well, yeah,
all right.
Close enough.
The Warhammer fantasy brought back.
Warhammer the Old World. Sorry, I'll stop.
Yes, that's been entry number 2 into our Lord of the Rings trilogy. Thank you so much for listening. Please like, please subscribe. We reshare anything you share on Instagram. We respond to every comment on YouTube. There are some great ones. We got the best fans in the fucking world. Ciao. Have a good one.
Peace.